I was just trying to decide as I before I walked in what I was going to speak about tonight, and I finally decided, and I came in, and David, the audio engineer tonight, he said, "What's your title so I can write it down?" So I said, "My title is I want to talk about my three greatest objections to Orthodox Judaism." He said, "You're kidding." I said, "No, I'm serious." He said, "But you're kidding, right?" So no, I actually would like to speak about my three greatest objections to Orthodox Judaism, and hopefully it'll take us to interesting places that are appropriate for everybody who is here tonight. I'll explain. You cannot encounter the world of observant Jewry without noticing that they are, and I don't think this is too strong a word, obsessed with detail. I grew up in a traditional home. We weren't religiously observant like the Orthodox, but we were traditional. And we had a concept of the Shabbat. When did Shabbat start for us? So Shabbat started at sundown. And when did Shabbat leave? It left at sundown the next day. That's how we always thought. Then you run into these Orthodox Jews. And what time does Shabbat start? Starts at 4:11 and 17 seconds. On this side of town, it's 18 seconds on the other side of town. They have to eat so many ounces of matzah within so many minutes and make sure that you put on your right shoe before your left shoe. Yeah, make sure you tie your left shoe before your right shoe. The level of obsession with picking any detail is astounding. You can't help but miss it. One of the first questions that I had when I encountered this community was, why are they so obsessed with detail? What is that? Take that question, put it on the shelf for a minute. Second question. When I started studying Torah for the first time ever in my life, the yeshiva that I stumbled into was not set up for people who had very little background like myself. And the head of the yeshiva gave me an hour a day, which was very nice because he was a very busy man. And the rest of the day, there were high school students who would tutor me. So I wasn't a religious Jew at the time. I wasn't terribly observant. And I wouldn't come in the morning for the prayers. 7:30 in the morning, they used to have prayers. At 8:30, they had breakfast. That's when I showed up. Yeah, I would say through breakfast, 8:39. At 9 o'clock, they began the Talmud study, which is what I was really interested in. And I would stay there for the Talmud study from 9 until 1. And then at 1 o'clock, they had their afternoon prayers. Now, even though I wasn't terribly religious, I felt it was not in good taste to just walk out at that point. So I didn't have to come for the morning prayers, but to leave when they started the afternoon prayers, they didn't want to be offensive. So I would stay for the afternoon prayers, and while they were all praying, I got an English translation of the prayer book. A prayer book had just come out. This was 1983. A prayer book had just come out, published by a company called Art Scroll. Yeah, it was the first book they ever published, and I have the first edition of the first Art Scroll Siddur that was ever issued. Yeah, and while they were praying, I would sit and I would read the commentaries on the bottom of the book. They were very interesting. One day, one of the high school students who was tutoring me comes up to me after prayers, and he says to me, "Kelman, you don't pray right." So I said, "Excuse me." So he says, "I've been watching. You don't pray right." So I said, "What makes you think I'm not praying right?" He says, "I see you're just reading the book. You got to say the words." Okay, so my mind is now working like the philosopher. I'm trying to go the next step. If he says I have to say the word, what is he thinking? And I couldn't believe where I thought this was going, so I said to him, "Why do I have to say the words?" And he says, "You have to say the words. If you don't say the words, you didn't pray." So I said, "Do you think that the God that you believe in doesn't know what's in my heart?" So at this point, this poor high school student became all flustered and ran away. Okay. He comes back a minute later, and he's got this massive folio-sized book, which he slams down on the table and starts gesticulating and pointing and screaming, saying, "It says here you gotta say the words!" So at that point, another couple of other staff members at the yeshiva came and grabbed him and carried him off by the arms. Yeah, but it was too late because he'd already spilled the beans. He'd already told me. These Orthodox Jews believe in a God that if you don't say the words, it's not called prayer. What is that? He doesn't know what's in my heart? What kind of a God is this? Yeah? This is beginning to sound like neo-paganism. Yes? Question number one, why so much detail? Question number two, why do you have to say the words? Question number three. There was a rabbi at the yeshiva who I fell head over heels in love with. An amazing, amazing man. The problem was, everyone else was head over heels in love with him as well. And I could not get a moment with him. All day, from the time he walked into the study hall until the time he left, there was people all over. What I discovered was, if I showed up for breakfast at 8:30, there was no one sitting with him at breakfast. So I would come to breakfast every morning, and I would pummel him with all of my questions at breakfast time. And every morning at breakfast, this man would serve up this intellectual feast. I mean, it was spectacular. I think all of my questions basically follow the same format, which is, why do I have to keep Shabbos? Why do I have to keep kosher? Why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do that? And every time I would ask one of these, he would deliver this intellectual feast. I mean, it was astounding. I remember I could taste his answers. They were so good. This went on for 3 or 4 months. One morning, I asked him a question. The truth is, today I don't remember even what the question was, but I'm sure it was the same format as all my other questions. And he said to me, "You know, Kelman, you keep asking the wrong question." So I said, "What do you mean?" At this point, my radar was going up. I was suspicious to begin with. So I said, "What do you mean I'm asking the wrong question?" He said, "You keep asking, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do that? Don't you realize?" he said. And then this man said so proudly, as if he was sharing with me, right, the secret of the religion. He said, "Don't you understand? Our theme song," remember he said, "our mantra is," and then he said the Hebrew words, "Na'aseh v'nishma." We do it even if we don't understand it. And I remember looking at him and thinking, like, what are you talking about? Not that I was surprised that if you scratch an Orthodox Jew, you find a mindless fanatic underneath. That I expected. What shocked me was, I'm a pretty good reader character. I thought he understood me. Here was a man who, whenever he spoke to me, he was bilingual. He not only spoke yeshivish, he spoke academic. Yeah? We could speak the same language. Didn't he understand? I was educated at UCLA and Harvard. What was he thinking that made him think that I would appreciate we do it even if we don't understand it? Why was he so proud? Why didn't he try to hide that from me? Why so much detail? Why do you have to say the words? And what was this man thinking that made him think that I would appreciate we do it even if we don't understand it? Fast forward the movie now 10 years. 10 years later, I'm sitting in a lecture in the deepest, darkest part of ultra-Orthodox Jerusalem. There's a great sage who's sitting up in front of the group with a long white beard. Man in his 70s. Everybody in the room except for me is religious from birth. Most of them born in Jerusalem. And this man is explaining to them the essence of Torah. And he comes out with this thesis which they slept through. I mean, they thought it was just ordinary, but I thought it was incredibly provocative. This man claimed that every aspect of Torah, every aspect of Judaism, is intended to craft a creature who will be competent in intimacy. That was his claim. That it's a system for creating lovers. That's the whole purpose of Judaism. That was his claim. Now, this was not apologetics. This was not Jewish outreach. He was speaking to a group of Talmudic scholars, 150 of them in a room. Right? Yerushalmi, these people have been born in Jerusalem and raised in Jerusalem. And he's quoting Talmudic source after Talmudic source. And I walk out with my head spinning. Okay, I keep lists of all my questions. I keep these little notebooks, and I write down these little notebooks, all of my questions. I remember I came home that night, my mind was on fire with everything that he had said, and I started going through my notebooks, crossing off question after question after question. The more that I thought about what he said, the more I realized I had been involved in something and misunderstood what it was from the beginning of my involvement. This religion that I thought was Judaism was something completely different. Can I explain what I mean? I've been involved now fairly seriously in marriage counseling, marriage and couple counseling, for about 15 years. I've never had, in 15 years, a couple come to me where their relationship was on the rocks, where they were having difficulty in their relationship because of a disagreement over a major theme. Meaning that she's a Republican and I'm a Democrat. I want a divorce. That's never what happens. If you would sit in my office, unless you have background in marriage counseling, if you would sit in my office, you would not believe the discussions that take place. I'll have a couple come in. There's a real live discussion. They say, we're here because we hate each other. So I say, you're confident of that. Well, she hates me. And she'll say, and he hates me. So I'll say, what makes you think that your spouse hates you? And he'll say, when I married her, I told her I couldn't stand crumbly toothpaste. And every night she leaves the cap off on purpose. And she says, I don't leave it on purpose, I just forget. He says, you don't read it on purpose, it's been 15 years already. I say to her, what makes you think that he hates you? He says, every night, when he uses the restroom, and he leaves the restroom after using it, he leaves the seat up, and when I go, I always come He says, I forget. He says, you don't forget, you do it on purpose. Okay, now, I here have a couple in front of me that's getting a divorce over a toilet seat and toothpaste. Okay? Now, and you have to keep a straight face as they're speaking to you. I had a couple come to me, this was here recently, a couple came to me. I knew him before he got married. I didn't know his wife. But he told me, he came to me to speak to me alone, he said he was going to divorce her. So I said, you just got married, what's wrong? He said, it's the straw that broke the camel's back. I said, what's the straw that broke the camel's back? What's wrong? He said, I started to grow a beard. She doesn't like my beard. She wants me to cut my beard. This is the straw that broke the camel's back. I can't take it anymore. I never get what I want. I said, you're going to divorce your wife over a beard? I said, give me a knife, I'll cut your throat, or I'll cut your beard. Yes, I mean, this is insanity. You're going to get a divorce over a beard? Okay. Cases like this come up literally every single day in my office. I mean, there was a man who came to me, he wanted to divorce his wife because she sent him to the ice cream store and told him that she wanted a lot of sprinkles on the ice cream. And he put sprinkles on the ice cream, but he didn't put enough. She wanted him to bring a whole cup back. And she got angry with him because he didn't bring the cup back and said, now he wants to divorce her. Now this, you think that all the people who visit me happen to be insane, yeah? But it's not true. The more that you're involved in counseling, the more that you realize that all relationships rise or fall based on attention to little tiny details. And I believe I understand why that is. Look at the flip side. Every now and then, rarely, a couple will come to me and their relationship is flying. I had a very cute couple come to me recently. They met me in my house. And my wife came and told me that they're waiting for you in the kitchen. So I walked over to, we have a sliding door that separates our kitchen from the rest of our house. I walked over the door. And I very respectfully knocked on the sliding door, assuming I had given proper notice, and then opened the door. Now this couple was newly married. And they, when I opened the door, they were very involved. They hadn't noticed that I had knocked. And they were both sitting in one chair. So, realizing the problem, I closed the door, and then I knocked a little louder, opening the door. That did not dissuade them. I came in, sat across from them, they slowed down. They sat in two separate chairs. And then I said, can I help you with something? So they said, well, we came for advice about our marriage. I said, to be honest, your marriage looks like it's doing just fine. So I said, as a matter of fact, maybe you could give me some hints, yes? So I said, tell me something. Do you think that your spouse loves you? It's a question I ask often. The more you think about the question, the more you appreciate the significance of the question. So I remember he looked at her and said, yeah. She looked at me and said, yeah. So I said, tell me something. What makes you think your spouse loves you? So he said something so interesting. He said that when he came home from work and he would open up the door and walk into the salon, so he would, often his wife would be there, and when she would look up, he said, she would see him and she would smile. That's how he knew that she loved him. I said, that's it. He said, no, sometimes she makes me a cup of tea. I said, that's it? He said to her, what makes you think he loves you? So she says, sometimes when he goes off to work, he leaves me a note on the refrigerator. Then she started to giggle, and she said, this morning, it only had 3 words. So now, is this what makes a good marriage? A cup of tea and 3 words on a refrigerator note? So over the years, I've become persuaded, yes, that's what makes a great marriage. But it's all in the details, and I think I'm beginning to understand why. Because if I remember her 25th anniversary, that does not mean that I love her. I have to be an idiot to forget her 25th anniversary. I mean, if I forget it, I should be shocked. Yeah. But assuming that I remember it, that doesn't mean that I love her, because how could I miss the 25th anniversary? But I remember that 25 years ago, on our first date, I remember I took you out to this restaurant. Do you remember that? I remember what you ordered. You ordered this. And I remember you wearing a maroon dress. And do you remember that night I brought you the yellow roses with the lavender ribbon and a lot of the white poof stuff they put in the top? Yeah? Do you remember that? The fact that I remember those details, that means I love her. When you remember the details, that's significant. Okay, now I have a fantastic idea for a self-help book, but I have no time to write it, so I'm giving over to Rabbi Hirsch, and he's going to give me 75% of the profits. My idea for the self-help book is like this. It's the only thing like this on the market. No one has done this yet. It's a self-help book for relationships. You open the book, you follow the exercises, and it will make you a competent lover. How does it work? Like this. Since all success in relationships depends on how carefully you attend to the details, so this book will have like lots and lots of detailed exercises. And you have to practice these exercises. In order to practice them, you have to pay attention to all the details. And the book will include hundreds, 613 exercises. Okay, now begin to understand where I'm going. There are 613 categories of Jewish law, which include thousands and thousands of little detailed mitzvahs. This old man with a long white beard, this great Jerusalem sage, he said the reason the Torah is so specific, is so detailed, the reason we are required to attend in such degree to the picky details of Jewish law, it is the only training for relationship. Because only when I show that I care about the little tiny details, only then do I have a chance of getting it right in marriage. The couples that I've interviewed, where one of the spouses says, I basically got it right. I mean, I knew her birthday was in March. Those are relationships where the problems happen. And the relationships where the people are very attentive to details, they're doing very well. Question number one. Why do you have to pay attention to details? Because all success in a relationship depends on how tuned into details you become. Details. I'm sorry, details. California pronunciation. Two. But why did these Orthodox Jews insist that I had to say the words when I prayed? Doesn't their God know what's in my heart? So over the years, I've noticed that while there is some crossover, generally there is a language I would call masculine language, and there's a language I would call feminine language, masculine speech and feminine speech. Now, I do believe that all women at various times during the day use masculine language, and I believe that all men at various times during the day use feminine language to one degree or another. But men are dominant when it comes to masculine language, and females are dominant when it comes to feminine language. Okay, now what's the difference? Masculine language is functional. It achieves things in this world. It moves things around. It fixes things. Men tend to speak when something needs to be said in order for there to be some sort of repair or building that takes place. This can be very frustrating for women. It's a very common scene that the woman will come home and she'll say, yeah, I have this and this and this happened and this happened. I know what to do and I did this. What do you think about that? And he says, yeah. And I'm so embarrassed. I felt this. What do you think about me feeling this? Good. Okay. And at some point she feels like grabbing him and shaking him by the collar and saying, talk to me. Okay. Now, the reason he's not speaking is because nothing actually needs to be said. If she would present a problem, he would go on for half an hour explaining the solution. But as long as nothing needs to be said, he'll often remain quiet. Now, women, on the other hand, will speak even if nothing needs to be said. Okay, have you ever been involved, I'm speaking here to the women as well, have you ever been involved in a conversation with a woman, and she will sometimes repeat in a conversation the exact same detail, sometimes even twice. Has this ever happened to you, that a woman will say the same detail twice in a conversation, right? In a rare case, three times, that ever happened, yes? Okay, have you ever seen two women walking down the street and they're both talking simultaneously, yes? Okay, now, this does not mean they're not trying to communicate. There's something else going on. What's going on is this, that women are sensitive to an effect of conversation that men are largely blind to. And that is, while it's nice when someone speaks to me, women are acutely aware that the more that I speak to somebody else, the closer that I draw to them emotionally. Or another way of saying that is, I believe that even little girls, I mean from the time that they're very young, are extremely sensitive to their position in what I come to call love space. That is, a woman is very aware of whether she's moving into a relationship or she's moving further away from the relationship. And because women have the sensitivity, even when they're very, very young, what ends up happening is they become aware of what moves they make which propel them forward or backwards in relationships. And therefore, very early on in a little girl's life, she realizes that when she talks to somebody, she feels closer to the one that she's talking to. Therefore, when women want to draw close, they will speak. Women accomplish something with their speech, but it's not in the physical problem-solving realm. It's in more of a spiritual, emotional realm. When women speak, often what they're doing is they're drawing close to the other. What I noticed is that in the world of these Orthodox Jews, there's something I would call masculine speech and something I would call feminine speech. They have, let's take a look at masculine speech. Masculine speech in the world of these Torah Jews would be, let's say, before they eat an apple, they ask permission. May I please have that apple? Could I please own the apple? I don't want to eat somebody else's apple. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Borei Pri Haetz. And then they eat the apple. That blessing that they say before they eat the apple is a problem-solving blessing. The apple now belongs to me. I can now eat it. Thank you for giving that to me. Afterwards, I might even say, thank you. Borei Nefash Dos Rabos. Thank you very much for giving me that apple. There are blessings before and after. It's all very functional. There is a type of speech within the Torah, Jewish legal realm, which I would call feminine speech. And that is, they have this prayer, the 19 blessing prayer, which they say three times a day. Yeah, how do they do it? They take three steps back, right? Three steps forward, right? They then, and then they start this whole whispering procedure. What is this all about? I took a course for 3 years with this Jerusalem sage on how to be a husband. It was a course just about what do you need to do to be a proper husband, which, by the way, it turns out is almost as complicated as how to be a wife. This course was unbelievable. There were five of us who sat there, and every week you would give over another technique, the Torah behind it and a technique. We would go home, we would try these techniques, we would call each other on the phone. It was unbelievable. I mean, every technique he gave us, boom, it would transform the relationship. I mean, every single time. So after a couple of years, I mean, we would just sit there with our mouths open as he would speak, saying, like, how did you know this? One night, he's talking to us and he says, if you do not spend private time with your spouse, that is completely uninterrupted, protected, blocked off time, no cell phones, no kids, no interruptions. He said the time at least twice a week. Three was even better, he said, but at least twice a week. If you don't do that, he said, your relationship is headed for a fall. even if it seems okay now, if you don't block this time off and make a habit of it, the relationship is headed for a fall. So, after the talk, when he was done, we all got to ask questions. I said, okay, Rebbe, you told us we should spend private time. How do I do that? So remember, he looked at me like, wow, you're a bigger idiot than I thought. So I said, no, it's just that I want to know how you would recommend that I do that. So he said, do you ever eat at restaurants? So I said, yeah. He said, in that case, what I recommend is you find a nice restaurant somewhere in Jerusalem where there are none of your students. I recommend you get a table in the back where no one's going to bother you. I recommend you ask the maitre d' to please set two places, one across from the other. You take your wife to the restaurant. The candles sit across from each other. So he said, don't you feel how small the room becomes? Whisper. I try this. Don't do this unless you're married, okay? Okay, this is extremely powerful. I went back to him the next week and I said to him, where did you get that? I always suspected that in the bathroom he was reading psychology. You know? So I said to him, where did you get that? So he said, I found it in the code of Jewish law. So I said, where? Laws of dating? I mean, like, come on, you know, be real. Where did you find that? He said, right here. And he pulled the book off the shelf. The first volume of the code of Jewish law. He opened it up. And he pointed out to me, it's right here. And he showed me there in the laws of prayer. It says, when you want to have an intimate moment with God, what you do is first take three steps back. Find a restaurant where there's none of your students. Take three steps back from the whole world. Then sit right across from your wife. Take three steps forward. Not because God doesn't know what's in your heart. If you would have a woman with extrasensory perception, she could read minds. And she was married to an ordinary man. So this man would never have to speak because she could always read his mind. But since the man was an ordinary fellow, she would have to speak to express what she was feeling. If this couple was married over the years, so she would fall deeper and deeper and deeper in love with him. Because the more that you open yourself up and give verbally from deep within, share who you are with the other, that act of speaking, that makes you fall in love. That's what women are sensitive to, is the more that I speak to somebody, the more that I love them. And that man would end up left out of the relationship because he never had to speak. She would get all the information. She'd be able to read his mind. But he never had the opportunity to do the act which causes you to fall in love. God loves you far more than you could ever comprehend. With one quart of oatmeal in my cranial vault, I will never understand how much he loves me. Now he just wants me to join him in that relationship. So he says, please talk to me. Not because I don't know what's in your heart. I know what's in your heart. I want you to fall in love with me. If you want to fall in love, you have to open yourself up and you have to talk. You have to share. You have to talk about thoughts, feelings, values, dreams, fears. And the more that you speak, the more that you'll love. You're not speaking for the sake of your spouse. You're speaking for your own sake, because that's the only way to get involved in the relationship. Why do you have to talk in prayer? Not because he doesn't know what's in your heart. It's the only way to fall in love. Why so much detail? Because that's what all relationships rise or fall based on. But what was that rabbi thinking when he said, Nasta v'nishma, we do it even if we don't understand it? Why did he think a Harvard, UCLA educated student would appreciate such a thing? Didn't he realize I was an academic? How could I appreciate this closed-minded fundamentalism? I give a course at Neve with a whole series of lectures on intimacy. And every semester I try to hit on a few different topics so that over a period of time people hear different things. A few years ago I was giving a lecture on giving in to irrational requests. It's a topic which comes up in a lot of my counseling. A couple will come in, he or she requested something which is just like insane. And the other spouse, trying to keep some normalcy in a relationship, said, I'm not going to cooperate with that. That's craziness. So I was trying to explain in the lecture that as long as what the person is asking